accession number 26561, reel 10.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 10. We're talking about your time at Stalagluft 1 at Bath, and we were talking about your beer production, and the first batch you made tasted of barley wine, which is a drink, but not as popular as beer. So how did you refine your beer production?
Well, I went along to the doctor and discussed it with him. He was an British Army doctor, Montuit. And he said, oh, what you need to do is to something like quinine. I said, well, where the hell would I get quinine from? He said, you're in luck. He said, I've got some tablets of the stuff here. And so he gave me some of these tablets, which I put into the thing. And I also flavoured it again with a sort of mint leaves from the mint tea stock, which we had no use for, and it developed a better thing. But the real thing was later on, when I went and bungled the German canteen for beer, proper beer.
We'll come to that. Now, so that's another thing you made. What else were you making?
Not
the escape orientated stuff. We are going to come on to all that, but I know you made some stuff for that, and the radio, so, but other things you made for sort of improved quality of life.
Yes, biscuits, particularly the Canadian Red Cross biscuits, were large and very nutritious. They were giant things, about 4 inches across, very big biscuits. And for a grinder, I got a rotary roller out of wood and got a piece of tin can plate and a nail, and I made nutmeg grating tin to wrap around this roller, which was put into a position rather like the old-fashioned till, with a sloping thing where you wrote things on, and a drawer at the bottom, and you'd push the biscuit down this chute, turn the handle for the rotary nutmeg grater, which would all fall into the tray before underneath, and you pull it out and you've got flour, and you might ground it a little bit further with a bottle to turn it into flour, which you'd probably make a Christmas cake with. And we'd save up our very meagre ration of sugar, which was about a quarter of a cupful each a week. And that was all saved, and we used saccharine tablets from the canteen in lieu. And we'd save this up, and we'd save margarine and things like that, and we'd build a cake. The cake would be done in these homemade tin trays,
Made from Klim again, I suppose.
Klim tin tays, and would be pegged together. But it was far too hard. I didn't get the aeration. So somebody said, "Well, the doctor could help us here with bicarbonate of soda." And so I went to the doc and said, "Look, Ronson," he said, "Why is everybody coming to me for bicarbonate of soda?" And then he found out what it was, and he put a stop to it, because his ration wouldn't run to everybody having for their Christmas cake. And then I hit on the bright idea that the canteen sold a very crude form of tooth cleaning powder, which had a minty taste, and that contained bicarbonate of soda. So we used foamy powder in lieu of bicarbonate of soda to aerate the cake and make it lighter. And then it would be coated with white condensed milk, sugary topping, and pegged together in the form and decorated with some colouring or something. And what that was a Christmas like? Cake. Very good to us in those days. And the other thing we would do in the cookery thing is save our potatoes, let them go cold. And if we had a small tin with a lid, which sometimes came with home parcels from biscuits in it, we would line the tin can with this mashed potato, and then we'd save some of the potato and get some OXO cubes and soak the lumpy pieces and put it in the middle and put another potato covering and shove it in the ashes of the fire, and it would make a pie.
So that's the sort of some of the things you were, that's the thing. Now, what happened first? Were you asked to do things for the escape committee, or did the escape committee spot the sort of things you were making?
Yes, the latter, yes.
They saw you were making things.
Yes, I was very keen do-it-yourself.
You made this key that opens everywhere.
Yes.
Now, did you make that before or after you were asked by the escape committee to?
Before. Yes.
Now, tell me about that, because we are really interested now. How did you set about the? Did you have any knowledge of locksmithry at all before?
Other than rudimentary ideas, just that I knew how clocks and locks worked. And I put it to good use.
Now tell me
the gating.
How did you do it? I mean,
well, all I did, I made a sort of miniature hatchet head on the end and beat it out with a piece of fire bar and in my little burner stove, my turbine stove, and
the point of that was to make it case hard, i.e. harder than it would have been, so that it would.
Yeah, but I heated it up to do a blacksmith job on it, you see. And just made it sort of L-shaped with a loop handle. And I got it down, fairly thin blade, case hardened. And you'd go in sideways. And the main thing about the German locks at that time was getting past the first complicated guard. And if I could get through that, I could find the notch in the lever which would pull out the bolt.
Now how? Without?
Well, just twisting it. Getting past the gate was the safety factor from the owner's point of view.
I'm not quite sure how you did it, though.
I went in with this blade, sort of. It wasn't too big and not too small. In order to get past this gate, this complicated gate, which, you know, the keys are normally different things, and get to the bar with a notch in it so that I could flick it back.
But how would you get time on a German lock to play about and find the right shape and form of this?
Well, they had a lock in each hut. And the other thing about the Germans snooping on us and locking us up for the night was they would send ferrets up into the roof who knew who were German, English qualified, and listen to conversations. Over in the officers' compounds, they'd put microphones in there and... what was his name? Hornblower, we called him. Lieutenant Commander, Air Fleet Air Arm. Put the mains to it and blew up all the microphones. but we had them, and we would get the German ferrets, we called them. Ferrets were security, internal security guards. And they climbed up on a ladder into the roof, which was a double... a proper ceiling roof, and when they were up there, we'd get a broomstick and knock it through the ventilation bars over the door and knock their ladder down. And
How effective do you think the German ferrets, the security guards, were?
Oh, they were very good, yes.
They were good?
I think, yeah, we made friends with them, you know. But we had this duty pilot, which used to sit in a hut facing the gate. And we had a log as to when he came in, who came in. We gave them all code names. Bean Kopf and all sorts of things like that, bean head, you know. And we knew exactly where the people would tell into the duty pilot. And on one occasion, the Germans found this book, and in consequence of that, they disciplined and penalised the guards who should or should not have been in the camp on a log.
But so the duty pilot would log everyone and be told every movement. He would act as a focal point, and everyone would go and tell him.
You know where the guards were at any time.
The guards and the ferrets.
Yeah.
Now, when you got this key, would the same key open all the locks, or would it?
Most of them, yeah. The locks were different in so much as they had a different corrugated guard. And if you get past that corrugated guard, you'll soon find the bolt bar.
Was it just a matter of fiddling then with the
bolt
bar? I mean, you didn't need a new key, you just needed to fiddle it.
Just that one key, yes.
So the thing was to get through the first bit, and then it was just fiddly.
Yes.
Now, what did you use the key for?
Oh, getting into... the first time I used it was to burgle... Getting there Christmas and we...
Well, let's have that story now. That was
with your
wrestling
Tiny Bustle, yeah. He
and
tell
me about that,
another stubber. We built a stretcher with the crossbars to keep it stretched. And two handles at each end. And I went in as the locksmith. And we cut through the wire with our wire cutters, which are made out of two fire bars. With a case hardened cutting edge, and snipped through the wire, and took another piece of wire to couple it up when we get away. And so we went under there into that thing, into the German canteen, hence my locksmith activities, and we got this biggish barrel of beer, put it on the stretcher. And in the dark, and raced through back again into our own compound. But on another occasion, on the radio side, I'll come to that.
So you stole a barrel a bit. I mean, the Germans must have noticed, or didn't they?
Oh, somebody got smacked for diddling the accounts of the beer. Yes, and it was broken up and used as fuel. Of course, the barrel.
And you drank it as soon as possible, or did you save it till Christmas?
We saved it. I don't know who distributed it, but it probably distributed in the big carrier cans, aluminium carrier cans. Yes.
Now, that was December 41, would it be?
Yeah.
Now, at what point did you start to get involved in the escape side of thing and the wireless side of things?
About shortly after that, yes.
That drew attention to you in a way.
Yes. This is...
Now, who approached you?
What to do it? I just got cracking and made it, you know. There was another character making them at the same time.
So you weren't asked by the escape committee to make a wireless, you just set about making it?
Yes. And my tunnelling... tunnelling at Bath, where I got my name, Stinker.
But that which comes first, the wireless or the tunnelling? Well, we've been doing them
simultaneously. Yeah.
Let's look at the wireless first, then.
Yeah. Okay.
How did you make a wireless? I mean, it seems impossible to somebody that's not technically minded like myself.
Yes.
And most of the people listening to this, I'm sure. How did you do it right from the start? Even if it's detail that you know, I won't understand.
Yeah. The first one was the parts were obtained from Germans, who brought in lots of parts.
From bribery?
Bribery. We'd tempt them and give them coffee from the Red Cross parcels.
So this wasn't you operating on your own? This is part of the escape committee?
Oh, yes.
How did they get
parts? Well, they sort of softened them up with all sorts of gifts of cigarettes and coffee and chocolate, to the point where, they sort of indirectly threatened to shop him if they didn't bring in the goodies that they wanted.
And what sort of parts would they bring in?
The valves were essential, and in the early days I got the transformer for the heaters for the thermionic valves. Odd collection of bits of old broken radio and were shipped in, and that was fine. And later on.
So what did you do then?
I built into a small box, which went on a piece of cord. I was kept in the hospital, which had a double burner, a double brick thing. In other words, it was in a wooden hut, which the chimney was separate, and there was another guard wall around the chimney. And the space between there was ideal for hiding things. So I put a nail into the side of the hood and a long cord, and dropped this box with all the radio bits in it down this hollow double section chimney, double wall chimney.
Now, this first one, had there been any difficulties in building, or had you had all the parts supplied? And were just actually putting it together, which you already knew.
Yes.
So this wasn't a technically amazing feat. It was competent wireless engineering.
That's right, straightforward.
No particular originality of building condensers or wires or anything.
No. That happened much later on.
So this first wireless worked well, did it?
It's reasonably well, yes.
And what would you tune it into?
Into the BBC, 9 o'clock news.
And now what?
The thrill of getting the Big Ben signal was quite profound, yes. It really made the backs of my hair stand on end to hear the Big Ben striking, and this is the 9 o'clock news.
So who would listen to it? Would it be you?
I hadn't lost my hearing at that time.
You and anyone else?
I wasn't the best one for taking down the thing. Alan Morris would take it down. He's very good.
Alan Morris?
Yeah, he'd take it down in shorthand. And he would turn it into verbiage, and chaps who had been BBC announcers in civil life would go around the huts and read it in a posh BBC voice.
Now, what was the importance of the radio? I mean, I think I can see it, but and you mentioned the emotional charge, but what can you just sort of talk a bit about the importance of this news?
It was only used for news. It was not used as a musical entertainment. No, it was kept restricted use entirely. The wireless wasn't reliable, and you couldn't really to collect the electricity to drive it. The wall had a switch on it, and I dropped an extra wire down through the conduit to the switch, and took, because it's only one side is switched, it's the same line but it's got a connection at the bottom, so I had to bring down another lead for the other side of the mains, and I took one to each of the two screws that held the switch in position, with domed washers in between, homemade domed washers in the screw, between the screws, and I had little hooks that went onto the two screws, and I picked up the mains from that.
Now, I think you misheard me. I was saying, what was the importance of the news and the radio to the camp? I mean,
oh, it was for morale boosting, and then later on we found that through the letters, you know, the letter code, the letters home, to and from home, contained codification, which gave us stuff, and we were able to listen out for particular code words for various actions, particularly at the end of the war.
And these coded letters, did you write them, or would that be...
No, they were all organised by, through the BBC, onto the BBC.
But the letters...
Oh, the letters. No, I wasn't in the letter code business. There were only a few of those, but they were dealing with letters to their wives, which were intercepted by MOD.
So that was a two-way communication. You, by letter by wireless in.
Yeah, well, the thing about the letters was, you know, it might take a month or two for the things to get through. By the time we'd gone through British, German proofing, geproofed, monitoring, and censorship, and through the Red Cross organisation for letters to the other end to be investigated by the British people, and then send the letter got to his wife. Oh, she got a letter of any kind that hadn't been seen by the minister. She would send the letter to the air ministry or wherever.
So you built this. This was the first wireless you built.
Yes.
And it was reasonably successful, if from what you said, a slightly erratic.
Yes. And the tuning wasn't all that hot, you know. It sort of drifted off and so on.
Was that partly because you'd been using parts from broken radios?
It was edging on the frequency quite a bit. It was drifting on the frequency.
What would cause that?
Never found out, really. But,
did you then set about building another, or was one enough? I know you built others later, but
That was it for that time, yes.
Now, how were you recruited for the tunnelling? I mean, or was it your idea to start a tunnel? Do you see what I mean?
It wasn't my idea to start where it was started. I was co-opted as a volunteer.
Now, why did you volunteer? Tell us the background to volunteering for tunnelling and how you
I don't know, the escape committee, everybody discussed it, you know, what ways of getting through, and some would be, well, I hadn't worked on tunnels until this one, and somebody said the toilet was right on the no man's land edge, and that meant it was only a short distance through no man's land, under the wire entanglements, and onto the back of beyond there. So it was half the distance there, and a yard of tunnel is a ton of earth, which has to be got rid of. So, you know, tunneling is a very lengthy business. And what the Germans knew that tunneling was going on, and they had a seismograph king from Hamburg, a professor, put on a captain's uniform and came and put seismograph microphones into the posts.
Now, this is later, though, isn't it?
No, this is Bath.
This is before you'd started tunnelling, then?
Oh, yes.
So the microphones went in first before you'd started tunnelling?
We didn't know they had, but we surmised they were. Because I don't know how it was. So I think probably somebody had talked to the guards about it. Somebody was friendly with the guards.
Now, who did you volunteer? We're back to that. I mean, you know.
Well, somebody said we want volunteers for this tunnel. Who's keen to have a go at it? And I said I was. You know, I thought. it would be a good idea, and I had ideas. And they dug a V-shaped tunneling, anti-tunneling trough, trench, all the way around the camp, and they had these microphones, and we learned that we surmised that if he was monitoring this, the direction of the tunnel, he could do by cross-coordinate cocked hats from the various microphone beams, and he could tell where the activity was taking place from these coordinates on a particular point. So we said, right, we'll tunnel in three directions simultaneously, which confused his plotting considerably. And the advantage of the dummy tunnels was that we could backload them at the last stretch without having to surface and do them.
Now, what about the, tell us about the escape code, Betty.
Yeah, so
I mean,
did
this
one.
Them? Or did you just know of them?
I just knew of them, yes, but...
How did the escape committee operate, then?
I don't know. I was never on it, actually, other than getting guidance. I was just one of the labourers.
No, what did it do? Sorry.
It, through Dixie Deans or whoever was the camp leader, would control it, raise funds of Red Cross components to give to the escapees and so on. And it was very carefully planned so that two people didn't escape at the same time, so that it was controlled for the benefit of the successful one.
Now, how did you start your tunnelling activities?
Yeah, this is the one. When some of we had been tunnelling other areas, and it was very long before we, from the hut to the No Man's Land was a long tunnel.
Now, had you been doing that?
No.
No,
I started tunnelling.
You started on the
toilet. The one big toilet for those three huts was just on the edge of the No Man's Land, and there was a big cesspit underneath it, obviously, and it had a wash house attached to it. They just had the water to that spot. That's where we got our water from. A row of taps in a wash place and one shower head. And the toilets were next to those, about, I don't know how many seats. I think they're about getting on for 12 seats for, a fairly big camp. And underneath that was a brick-lined cesspit tank. And that's where the first part of the tunnel was put back into the cesspit. You climbed, you lifted the seat off, which was used for emptying, the emptying seat, with the whole lot lifted off with the lid as well. And they put pipes in and the honey wagon took it away, you know. And so the first tunnel, first part, I joined it shortly after that, was put back into the cesspit and built a little island rather than trudging through all the slush and turds and things. And that's how I got my name, Stinker, and I worked on this, and I found out, I said, well, we've got to get under the...
Now, hang on. What can you describe? I'm still not quite sure. The entrance to the tunnel then went from the cesspit?
Yeah. Underneath the lavatory seat.
And how come it wasn't filled with... I mean, how did you keep the shit and stuff out of it?
Yeah, well, you just backload. As you started the tunnel, you built up a little island in one corner near the entrance.
Of earth?
Of earth, from that you dug out, yes.
So the pit would be... They would keep it away?
Well, I never kept it away entirely.
Tell me about your nickname, Stinker.
Well, you would go down, you'd climb down naked in there because you... If you're putting in clothing, it would last forever, and the smell. And you'd come up and you'd have a cold shower and you'd clean and scrub, but you didn't get rid of the memory of it all. And what with that and my still brewing, and they said, God, you're always making a stinker.